Hi, welcome back to the channel. This video is a compilation of all of the best videos that I've posted over the last 7 days. If you haven't had time to watch all my postings, or you just prefer to come and watch everything in one video, then this is the right place for you. And don't forget that I include chapters in all of my videos, so it's easy to skip through if there's a topic that you're not particularly interested in. So before we get started, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up if you enjoy this content, and also don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already. So let's get started. This video is all about NFTs. If you've been wondering what NFTs are, how they work, what types of assets relate to NFTs, and why you should care about them going forward, then this is the video for you. This is the full beginner's guide to NFTs. And as with all my videos, we've got chapters included. So if there's a section that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip forward. So let's get started. So I'm sure everybody watching this video has heard of NFTs, but do you really understand what they are and how they operate? Well, NFT stands for non-fungible token. And even that breakdown is still confusing to me. Fungible is not a word that anybody uses in everyday life. It's one of those words that you're not quite sure what it means. Well, if you look at the definition in the dictionary, it states fungible means easy to exchange or trade for something else of the same type and value. So even the dictionary definition is difficult to understand, but what it actually means is replaceable or replicable. So if we were to replace fungible with replaceable in NFT, we would have non-replaceable token. So we're talking about something that is unique. There is only one of them. It can't be replaced or it can't be replicated. And that's why NFTs are of interest to the world, because they are a unique asset. And that's why they potentially could be worth a lot of money. Because when there's only one of something, then that is the ultimate in terms of rarity. And in the world of cryptocurrency and the digital world, anything that is scarce or there is only one of becomes valuable. So we now know that NFT relates to unique assets. But what sort of assets are we talking about, and what do we mean by unique? Well, the most obvious example in NFTs is art. The most famous artwork in the world is the Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci. And that is a physical piece of art. It's tangible. If you bought the Mona Lisa, you could take possession of it, and that would prove your ownership. There would also be some ownership documentation around it, but actually to prove that you physically owned it, you could have it in a safe in your house. Other people could take photos of the Mona Lisa, and they could have images of it on their wall, and they can have reproductions of the original artwork, but there is only one original. That is unique, and that's why it is so valuable, because everybody in the world who likes art would love to own the Mona Lisa. It can't be replicated, and it's irreplaceable. If it went up in flames tomorrow, then the Mona Lisa would no longer exist. All of the copies and the prints would still exist, but the original version of the Mona Lisa would be gone forever. Now, NFTs work on the same basis of rarity. There can be only one of each NFT in the world, and that's why it will have value, because somebody will want that NFT, and because there is only one, it then gets bid up in price when it comes into the secondary market. So an NFT is a digital asset which offers ownership to one party. So when you see images of an NFT, that only represents a copy of the original version. So it's exactly the same as the Mona Lisa example. The original of the Mona Lisa is held in the Louvre in Paris, and the original of any NFT will be held digitally on the blockchain. So how do NFTs work? Where are they stored? How do you prove you have ownership? And how do you trade them? As these are digital assets, it's all down to technology. And the core behind all of this technology is the blockchain. Now, the blockchain is a network of computers that are linked together that store transactions. No one individual or corporation owns the blockchain. It is a network of computers that is joined together all across the globe. So to explain this in very simple terms, I'll use the example of currency. So let's talk about US dollars and how your personal holding of US dollars is recorded. Now, these days, we've moved away from the cash society and we're now into the cashless digital world. And the way that system works is that you choose a particular bank that you want to bank with. So let's take an example of Bank of America. So when you open an account with Bank of America, you give them all of your personal details and they give you some unique details relating to your personal account. Now you give those personal details to your employer and at the end of the month, your employer transfers an amount of money to your personal account with Bank of America. So at any one time, you can log on and see exactly how many dollars you're holding with Bank of America. Now let's assume you want to buy a coffee from Starbucks. So you drop into your local branch, you order your caramel latte, the guy behind the counter says it's $5, and you wave your phone and pay with Apple Pay. What will happen at that point is that the payment system that Starbucks operates, and let's assume it's Stripe just for the sake of ease here, Stripe will contact the Bank of America where all of your funds are held, and they will ask for $5 to be transferred. Bank of America will then transfer a $5 credit to Stripe for Starbucks, and they will debit $5 from the ledger that they are holding in your name. So that's how the banking system operates. Everybody has confidence in Bank of America and Stripe and all of the other financial institutions. So if you had $1 million with Bank of America, you would feel very comfortable that it's in a safe place and it's not going to disappear overnight. And blockchain has been built to operate in a similar fashion, but without having corporates involved. So nobody owns individual ledgers. So in the banking example, we're talking about Bank of America. When you give your money to Bank of America, they are the company that then owns it. They have their own ledgers and you're using the Bank of America systems. Blockchain has been set up to operate on a universal basis. So we don't have individual companies that are owning portions of it. It's operated across the globe. Now, there are different types of technology that operate within blockchain, and Ethereum is one of those technologies. And Ethereum is the dominant player when we're talking about NFTs. That's the technology that most of the NFTs that have been issued has utilized. So coming back to the question of how does it work? How are NFTs stored and recorded on the blockchain? Well, this is all down to digital technology. So the digital asset is made up by coding. So this is a series of computer codes that create the digital asset that you can see. So the assets themselves exist on the blockchain and the ownership of those assets also is recorded on the blockchain. So all of this is done digitally. So it's exactly the same principle as your money in the bank with Bank of America. You have to have confidence in the blockchain and all of the security around it that once you buy an NFT and you become the registered owner of that unique asset, then you have to be comfortable that that is where it exists and that's where the ownership is recorded. It's as simple as that. An NFT does not exist in real life. It's an intangible asset. But once you're happy with the concept, then you can buy ownership of an individual NFT. So what type of NFTs are out there? Well, there is a huge number of NFTs available and the variety is increasing all the time. The highest profile and most common NFT is art. And art is split into two different categories, individual art and collections. Individual art is where one unique piece has been created by an artist. And the single most expensive individual art piece to date is Everyday's The First 5,000 Days by Beeple. And Beeple is a specialist digital artist, and this particular piece relates to 5,000 different artworks that he created over a period of 13 years. And it sold for $69 million in March 2021. And this part of the market is very similar to traditional art in terms of you have renowned artists and their pieces go for a lot of money. Alongside individual art, we've also got collections of NFTs. Now, this is the most famous part of the NFT market. If you've seen an article or something on the news relating to NFTs, it probably touched upon the collections. One of the earliest and most famous NFT collections is CryptoPunks. CryptoPunks were launched in June 2017 by two guys called Matt Hall and John Watkinson, who are based in Canada. And they used an algorithm to produce 10,000 different digital images of punks. And all 10,000 of these images were sold for Ethereum, and at the time, the value was around about $74 per image. Since then, the value of CryptoPunks has risen significantly, and it was reported in October 2021 that a single CryptoPunk NFT sold for $532 million. NFTs relating to music is also a fast-growing market. NFTs can relate to individual tracks, and a Whitney Houston demo song that she recorded when she was 17 recently sold for $1 million, or it can be a unique collection. So in 2021, the Kings of Leon released a new album, and they packaged up various different promotions into individual NFTs. And some of these offered lifetime passes to all of their future gigs, or there was original artwork that was only included on each individual NFT. And for artists that have a large fan base, this can be quite a lucrative source of income. In February 2021, Justin Blau, who's known as 3Lau, sold an NFT collection of his music for $11.6 million. Gaming is also a big growth area for NFTs. So you can own individual items or skins or weapons or anything that relates to a game. Some games are offering a pay-to-earn option where when you play, you can build up various items and then you can actually sell them to other players. So there is a secondary market for those NFTs. And the highest individual item that has sold so far is the Metaflower, which is a digital yacht that sold for $650,000. There are also NFTs that relate to memes. And the most famous one that sold so far is the Doge meme, which sold for $4 million. The LeBron James dunk, which sold for $208,000. But it doesn't stop at videos. People are also happy to buy NFTs relating to tweets. So Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, sold his first ever tweet for $2.9 million. And Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, recently sold the documents relating to his court proceedings for $5.4 million. So you can literally make an NFT out of anything you can think of. It doesn't have to be art. It can be videos, it can be documentation, it can be paperwork, it can even be computer game imagery. So why should you care about NFTs? What's the point of all of this? Well, these are an investment. And whether you buy into the crypto markets and digital currency or not, they are around right now and they are hot news. And this has been one of the fastest growing markets in investment terms that we've seen for a number of years. There has been a lot of profit made in NFTs over the last year or so. Whether it will continue, whether it's a bubble, whether it's about to burst, I can't answer any of those questions. But what I can tell you is that people are making serious money in NFTs right now. And this trend is continuing and looks likely to continue for some time yet. And one of the main reasons that it's become so popular is that we've now got a big secondary market. Now, there are a lot of different marketplaces, but the most famous at the moment is OpenSea. And the reason that the secondary market is so important is that that gives you liquidity. So if you buy an NFT, you can go and sell it on one of these secondary market sites. And the value of a lot of NFT collections has been rising rapidly. Now, one of the highest valued collections from 2021 is the Bored Ape Yacht Club, which launched in April 21 at around about $190 per token. And those tokens have sold collectively for more than $2.3 billion. If you want to buy a Bored Ape token today, it will cost you somewhere in the region of $1 million compared to $190. So that's why the whole of the investment world is so excited. If you can get on board to one of these new issue collections at an entry price of $150, $200, and it trades up, you could make 10, 100, 1,000 times your return in a very short space of time. Now, obviously, that is not going to happen to every one of these collections. There'll be some winners and a lot of losers. And there's also a lot of scams and what is known as a rug pull, where a collection is launched and then there's no support for it in the secondary market and the value craters to zero. But whichever way you look at it, this is a really interesting and exciting investment opportunity. Now, one of the main restrictions to this market is that you need to have some cryptocurrency to be able to buy these tokens. So you will need to create a wallet and do all of the things around buying cryptocurrency before you can step in and buy a token directly. But that really isn't that difficult to do these days, and it's probably worth putting in a little bit of time and effort so that you can get some ether and then be able to buy some tokens. So hopefully you've enjoyed this video and you now understand NFTs, what they're about and why they're worth thinking about a bit more than you did before you started. This video is an update on the Evergrande situation. I've been asked by a lot of viewers recently, why are Evergrande in such a dire financial position? If they've sold 1.6 million apartments on a pre-sale basis, and they're being paid anything up to 100% deposit, how is it possible that Evergrande can lose money? Because if you've got the sales guaranteed, you know you've actually done the sale, then you should be having guaranteed profit, and therefore you shouldn't be in financial difficulty. So it's one thing borrowing a lot of money to buy land and to develop the properties, but as long as you're making profit, and as long as you're getting more money in than you're spending, then there shouldn't be a problem. So that's the recurring question that I've been asked. And there is a very simple answer to that question. And the simple answer is that Evergrande have wasted hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And they've done that by getting involved in a lot of different ventures that had nothing to do with property development. So if they'd have just stuck to property development, then maybe they would have been okay. Maybe they'd have been able to repay the debt. Probably not, because they took on such a huge amount of debt that it was unlikely that anybody could have been able to repay that. But if the demand had stayed for the properties and they'd kept selling those properties, then in theory, they should have had enough money to carry on going. They would have had problems with regards to the three lines test, because the government brought in new restrictions, which meant that they had less debt available to them. But if they'd have been managing their cash properly, that shouldn't have been a problem. But they weren't. And in this video, what I wanted to do was to go through all of those schemes that Evergrande brought in that they have wasted so much money on. And the founder of Evergrande wanted to create a conglomerate. He wanted a business that does everything. And that was part of the problem. They got involved in a lot of different ventures that had nothing to do with property. They didn't have any skill set. They didn't have any customers. And in some cases, they didn't even know how to make the products that they were trying to deliver. So I've covered off these topics before in previous videos. But as the channel is growing, we've got a lot of new subscribers and a lot of new viewers. I wanted to put together a video that has everything in one place. Rather than hunting around trying to find old videos of mine, I wanted to create a one-stop shop which gives you all the data and information in one video. And as you know, I always include chapters in my videos, so it's really easy to be able to skip through anything that you're not particularly interested in. But I can tell you that this video is absolutely fascinating, because Evergrande has got involved in such a wide variety of different activities. So the most famous ones are the theme parks and the electric vehicles. That's the ones that they've spent so much money on. But they've also been involved in agriculture and cinemas and TV and film and banking and bottled water and baby milk and cosmetic surgery. You name it, Evergrande have had a dabble into something. And generally, they've spent billions of dollars doing so. So they have wasted a fortune. When you think of $100 billion, which is what Evergrande invested into their theme parks business, $100 billion, that's $100,000 million. That is bigger than a lot of household name companies that you could think of. So that is an enormous amount of money. And Evergrande have been frittering away this money over the last 10 years or so. And that is one of the reasons why they're in such dire financial situation now. If they hadn't have got involved in all these distractions, then they might have been able to trade through this and we might not be seeing the major problems that we've got right now in the Chinese economy. So in this video, I'll cover off all of the non-core activities that Evergrande has got itself into and out of over the last few years. So hopefully you'll enjoy this. Hopefully it'll put a smile on your face watching the sheer volume of businesses, but also the crazy ideas that these guys came up with. Why they thought Evergrande was going to be a success in some of these fields, I will never know. But hopefully you'll enjoy it. And if you do, then please give me a thumbs up at some point. And if you haven't subscribed already, then please do so. And the first business we'll talk about is baby formula. So this is powdered milk to be sold to babies, probably as far away from building houses as you can get. There was a big scandal in 2008 in China because some formula was found to have melamine, a chemical agent in it that was harmful to children. So there was a big reform in the industry in 2014 and Evergrande decided it wanted to be one of the big players. So it went out and purchased Koala Dairy, which was a New Zealand-based company, and then announced that it was setting up a factory to create its own baby formula. As with a lot of Evergrande ventures, things didn't quite go to plan, and one year later, they sold the business on. Next up is cosmetic surgery. Now, cosmetic surgery is big news in China. It's very popular amongst the middle classes. And in 2014, Evergrande announced that it had bought a stake in a South Korean cosmetic surgery business. It then went on to announce a deal with a cosmetic surgery hospital. Now, at the time when the deals were announced, Evergrande came out and announced that it was intending to deliver $2.7 billion of revenue in 2015, the following year. Now, no further update was ever provided, so I doubt if they got anywhere near 2.7 billion. And these businesses have now been folded into Evergrande Health, which is part of the Evergrande Group, and no individual details have been released since. But another crazy harebrained scheme getting into cosmetic surgery. Next up is magazines. So in March 2015, Evergrande announced that it had bought a Hong Kong-based magazine group called New Media Group for $122 million. Now, there was no real logic to this. There was no strategy. This wasn't a move into printed press or digital media. It was just a straightforward acquisition. No real follow-up was provided. So I can't give you an update as to what happened to the Hong Kong-based publishing business. I assume they sold it to somebody at some point in the future. It's not been mentioned since. I can't find any record of it. But another great scheme to get into publishing, which didn't really go anywhere for Evergrande. Next on the list is a hotel and holiday resort in Quebec, Canada. Now, this hotel is run by Fairmont Group and is the Chateau Montebello, if anybody has been there. It looks extremely nice. It's a 65,000 acre site with the largest log cabin in the world, which is the hotel. It has 210 rooms, a golf course, some really nice facilities. So a really nice hotel development based in Canada, but no idea why a Chinese property development business would be acquiring it and then also allowing Fairmont Group to carry on running it. No details of the acquisition were disclosed, but my guess is that they paid at least $500 million for this property. They still own it today, so it's still part of the group. No details are provided in terms of the performance, but it looks very nice if you go onto the website. And it looks quite an upmarket place. It's one of the top 10 resorts in Canada, as voted on TripAdvisor. So I think it's relatively successful. But again, crazy, crazy thing for a Chinese property developer to be doing. Next on the list is solar panels. Why not? So in October 2014, Evergrande announced that it intended to make a $15 billion investment into a 9.2 gigawatt Chinese solar capacity plant. Now, this was going to be the biggest
solar panel plant in the world at that time. So really quite a grand statement for Evergrande to make. They really wanted to hit this market hard. They wanted to become one of the biggest producers of solar panels globally. So quite bold and quite in keeping with a lot of the other statements that the Evergrande group made about various other businesses. And unfortunately, like a lot of the other Evergrande plans, it didn't really go anywhere. And 6 months later, Evergrande announced that it had scrapped the plans to become the biggest solar panel producer in the world. And that was the end of that. Anybody fancy cinemas? Well, Evergrande did. In 2014, they announced that they were building 77 cinema complexes all across China. They later announced plans to add another 30 cinemas and then followed that up by a statement that they wanted to have 150 cinemas across China by the end of 2016. They subsequently went on to acquire two cinema businesses in China, and no details have been provided, but our estimate is that they invested around about $1 billion into this venture. Now, there was an element of cohesion because they had some other media investments, but there was no direct link between those investments and the cinema business. So essentially, it was a standalone operation, very different to property development. Obviously, the building of the cinemas was relatively linked, but actually managing and running and maintaining cinemas is quite a different field, but quite fun anyway. Next on the list is hospitals. So Evergrande announced in 2013 that it was teaming up with Harvard University with a view to building some hospitals in China on a joint venture basis. They wanted to use Harvard University's expertise and their building expertise to create the perfect combination. And as part of this announcement, interestingly, Evergrande gave a huge donation to Harvard University. Now, nothing was disclosed about the amount of that, apart from it was seen as being a significant sum. So my estimate is that it was at least $500 million donation to Harvard, but it could have been as big as a billion. Who knows? At the time, I think the ego was running away with itself, so it could easily have been as high as a billion, but nobody knows. But they entered into this arrangement to build a series of hospitals. But unfortunately, it didn't quite work out like that. But they did have a link back to one of their earlier investments here, the cosmetic surgery side. So they have actually opened one hospital as a joint venture arrangement. And this is in a holiday resort, which has a focus towards cosmetic surgery, but also does have some other wards such as cancer. So that was opened in 2018. No financial details have been provided, but it's very different to the property development side of things. So obviously when you're building a hospital, you don't really make any money when you're building that. And then even when it's open, how do you make any money from running a hospital? It's a completely different business model. So another harebrained, crazy idea by the founder of Evergrande. My view here on this one is that he wanted the profile. He wanted to be seen as a good guy. He was doing something to help the community. He was helping Harvard University. He was using Evergrande's money to do this, so he was actually running down the cash reserves and building up more debt. But as long as he was having fun, I guess that was the main thing. In November 2015, it was announced that Evergrande had bought a loss-making life assurance business. And again, there was no real logic to this. They didn't have a large financial arm. It wasn't something they were looking to develop. There is a loose tie-in to some of the other health-related businesses that we've been talking about here, but no direct strategy, nothing really tying this to the rest of the group. At the time of the acquisition, Evergrande paid $617 million for the business, and it's reported that it was loss-making for a number of years. Now, I believe that it's now turned into profits, and it's been doing quite well for the last few years, but it can't be doing that well because there are reports recently in the press that Evergrande is now looking to dispose of the life assurance arm, and it's looking at a price of around about $600 million. So 6 years later, it's only breaking even on the deal. So not a complete disaster like some of the other investments here, but not really a huge success either. Next up is bottled water. So in January 2014, Evergrande announced that it was entering the bottled water market.
恒大冰泉，长白山上原始森林中的矿泉，长白山上深层火山岩冷泉，全程无空气接触灌装而成，天然弱碱性矿泉水，均衡富含对人体有益的多种元素，质量至上，恒大集团。
And as usual, Evergrande had grand plans. They wanted to be the biggest player on the planet, but after a couple of years of heavy losses,They decided to try to list it on the Hong Kong stock market. That didn't work. They weren't able to get that successfully away. And the business was eventually sold in September 2016, along with a number of other businesses that we're talking about on this list. One of the more successful investments that Evergrande made was Heng Ten. Now, Heng Ten is the Chinese equivalent of Netflix.So this is a digital media platform that provides content that people pay for. And it was set up as a joint venture with Alibaba in 2015. Now, no details have been provided as to how much money was invested by Evergrande, but the company did make losses for the first few years. And it's estimated that somewhere in the region of $2 billion was invested by Evergrande into Heng Ten. Now, if you've been following the videos, you'll know that they've recently sold out of their stake. At one point, they had a 55% ownership of Heng Ten, but they've now completely sold out of that position. And unfortunately for Evergrande, the share price plummeted during the course of 2021. So the cash that they managed to get out of the business ended up netting them a $1.1 billion loss. So at one point, it was doing quite well and was valued at around about $2 billion on the Evergrande balance sheet. But unfortunately, by the time they came to sell it, the value had fallen and they ended up making a loss. In March 2014, Evergrande bought a 5% stake in Beijing's Huaxia Bank for $546 million. But that was only really a dabble. And in 2016, they set their sights on buying into Shenzhen Bank. And over the course of 12 months,They acquired a 36% stake for around about $4 billion. Now, Evergrande has actually got itself into a little bit of hot water and is now being investigated by the regulators because they started taking loans from Shenzhen Bank. And there are strict rules in China about being able to borrow money from companies that you are invested into. So they're now being investigated for that.They subsequently sold the stake for around about $1.5 billion. So again, not a great investment because they've lost money on it. And they've also potentially got themselves into trouble by having a trading relationship with that bank. Okay, so now we're getting into the really fun stuff. So in 2010, Evergrande bought a football club, a soccer team in China. Now this team was actually sitting in the second division of the Chinese Football League and had been involved in a financial scandal where the manager had been sacked. And so it was in disgrace. But Evergrande stepped in, they bought the club, and then they poured a lot of money into the team and the management. So they hired ex-World Cup winning managers and overseas superstars. So they brought in a series of Brazilian strikers. They started with small amounts, so it was only $3 or $4 million to start with. But it culminated in the worst signing of all time when they signed Jackson Martinez and he only scored 4 goals. So each one of those goals cost Evergrande around about $20 million each. A complete disaster. And added to what they spent on the team and the management, they also designed an incredible football stadium in the shape of a lotus flower that they decided to build themselves. It was going to be the biggest stadium in the world. As you would imagine with Evergrande, always biggest, always best. So they had plans for the best stadium ever. Now, unfortunately, the crowd at the football club was around about half the size of the new stadium. So it was a completely pointless exercise building this huge stadium. They started the development of it. It had an estimated cost of $1.8 billion.They stopped work on that stadium a few months ago, and it's just been reported that the local authority, the government, has stepped in and seized control of that stadium. So they now own it. So Evergrande don't have any value whatsoever. So the football club in total cost Evergrande around about $4.8 billion. Now the club has now distanced itself from Evergrande. It's changed its name. It's dropped Evergrande from the title. So it has no relationship whatsoever. So a completely disastrous investment. There's no rationale for ever investing in a sports club as a business venture. This was really an ego trip from the founder. He had fun. Everybody enjoyed it for a short time, but a complete and utter waste of money. Next up is agriculture. Now, this is quite a mixed bag of investments, and Evergrande decided to get into a whole host of different parts of agriculture. So in August 2014, Evergrande announced that it was going to invest $16 billion into agriculture to become one of the big players in China. And they wanted to cover everything. So they had grain and vegetable oil and dairy and husbandry and pig farming and everything you could think of in agriculture. Now, as with most things that Evergrande got involved with, it didn't really work out that way. And they ended up selling the majority of their investments within a 12-month period. The penultimate investment on the list is electric cars. So the founder of Evergrande had been watching Elon Musk do very well with Tesla and decided that he wanted to do the same thing with Evergrande. So in 2018, he started by making an investment in a US company called Faraday Future. And he put $2 billion into this business. Now, Faraday Future had had a checkered past. It repeatedly said that it was bringing out a new vehicle and had failed to deliver on any of those timeframes. And they already had a Chinese chief executive who'd invested some money into the company previously. Now, Evergrande quickly fell out with this chief executive and he issued a lawsuit against Evergrande claiming that they hadn't given over the full amount of the $2 billion. Now, that debacle did not put Evergrande off. And they later came out and announced that they were investing $23 billion into the creation of three electric car plants in China. And they stated that they were going to be the biggest electric car company in the world and that they would be producing 1 million vehicles per year. So this was going to eclipse Tesla and all of the other major electric car companies. So where did we get to? What's happened? 3 years on, what have they done? Well, it's sad to say that unfortunately, they still haven't produced one car. So despite claiming they were going to be producing 1 million per year, they still haven't produced one. And it now looks like Evergrande is going to have to exit from the electric car business. They obviously don't have any spare capital. This is a very specialist field. A lot of people have failed in electric car production. A lot of car manufacturers have failed in electric car production. But a Chinese property development business thought that they could come in and smash the market within 3 years, that it was going to be easy peasy. It wasn't, it isn't, and it's never going to happen. So unfortunately, we still haven't seen any of the cars, and it's very likely that we will never see a car from that factory. So last, but by no means least, we've got theme parks. So in 2017, Evergrande announced that it was going to build 15 theme parks in China, and its intention was to be bigger than Disney. These theme parks were going to be bigger and better than anything anybody had seen before. They would have more rides, more experience, just be an amazing concept.
The innovative World Fairy Tale Park, presenting with five splendid themes. Chinese mythology, including Naja Conquers the Dragon King roller coaster, and a Monkey King wreaks havoc in heaven. Catch the train of fairyland. Pass through these classic stories. Ancient Greek fairy tale. Mechanical Troy horse. Sparta Warcraft. Revitalize the epics. Western Europe fairy tale. Adventure flight with a wizard of Oz. South America tribes. Amazon jungle rafting. Ancient Arabic mythology, miraculous exploration in Sinbad Flume Ride, as well as Aladdin 5D cinema, fantastic ocean world, covering tropical forest, deep ocean, and polar region. Three distinct biospheres. Over 10,000 species, including emperor penguin, polar bear, beluga whale, whale shark inhabit in 33 aquariums and venues to show the spectacular lives on Earth. Coastal Water Park, Stone Mountain in the tropical area, brings extremely cable-way experience, rafting through the ocean world. Water roller coaster, flow rider, free fall, speeding, and python slides. An opportunity to challenge the limit.
Each one of these parks was going to cost $7 billion each to create. Now, this was just a crazy idea because Evergrande has experience in construction, but clearly they've got no experience in entertainment and being able to staff up a theme park and work out what themes work, what rides to have, how to do everything relating to that whole event management business. So as with a lot of the other investments that we've talked about on this video, this theme park business did not come to fruition. They have started building a lot of the theme parks and they have wasted a lot of money. But unfortunately, we don't see any of these parks operational. And it's likely that the investment they made will become worthless because they have picked areas that are secondary cities all around China and there's not really any buyers for these assets. So it's a really sad story, and I thought I'd finish off the video today by showing you one of these abandoned theme parks that Evergrande has built. So hopefully you'll enjoy this video.
This video is an update on the Evergrande situation. We've now got some further news with regards to the construction activities of Evergrande, which I'll update you on. And we've also found out some really concerning news about some bond and share dealings by the chief executive of Evergrande, who's a guy called Shah Hyjan. We've been talking a lot about the chairman, Wee Kar Yan, and the chief executive has really gone unnoticed. But he's done something with regards to his holdings, his personal holdings, which I think are tantamount to insider dealing. So we'll go on and look at that in some more detail. And then we'll talk about what Evergrande's plans are for the rest of 2022. They've made an announcement about how many apartments they're intending to deliver. And then I'll wrap up with a summary with regards to what's going on with the Evergrande suppliers, because there are a lot of problems going on right now in the whole sector. A lot of it is caused by Evergrande not paying their suppliers. So we'll go to talk through the implications of that and how that will impact on Evergrande's ability to be able to carry on with their construction and to deliver the number of apartments that they're hoping to. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And remember that I include chapters in all my videos, so if there's a particular section you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip on to the next topic. So I'll start with the news about the chief executive of Evergrande selling some of his holdings in Evergrande's bonds and also some shares in the Evergrande electric vehicles business. Shah Hyjan is a 56-year-old businessman who has 32 years experience in property development and joined Evergrande in 2007. So he's been on board throughout the whole of the major growth phase of the business, and he would have been involved in all of the bond discussions and a lot of placing of the international bonds. Now, he has a large personal holding of these bonds, and there's no details provided, but it's likely that he would have been given some of these bonds as part of his remuneration package, because the amounts that he has are absolutely massive. And information has just been released now about the sale of some of these bonds back in the summer of 2021, which was about 3 weeks prior to the world finding out that Evergrande was in financial difficulty and that it looked like it was going to be unable to repay its debts. Between the 27th of July and the 17th of August 2021, the chief executive sold $50 million worth of bonds that were due in 2022, $50 million worth of bonds due in 2023, and $28 million worth of bonds due in 2025. Now, the prices that he sold these bonds at were below par, and they ranged between 35.9 cents on the dollar and 52.4 cents on the dollar. And those three sales generated a total of 56.5 million US dollars for the chief executive himself. So there's a number of issues that these sales throw up. Firstly, the chief executive of the company had $128 million worth of bonds, which must have been gifted to him as part of his package, but shows how much these guys were being paid personally. $128 million is a massive amount of money for anybody to be paid, and this is just a portion of the bonds that he's holding. The second issue is the timing of this sale. These bonds were sold in a 3 week period building up to the 17th of August 2021. And in September 2021, Evergrande failed to make a payment, and for the first time, the world became aware that Evergrande did not have enough money to meet all of its obligations. So there is a serious risk of insider dealing here. The chief executive would have been fully aware in August when he was making these sales that Evergrande was in massive financial difficulty. And he took advantage of the information that he had to sell out of a personal shareholding. Now, in the rest of the world, this would not be allowed. Chief executives of companies have blackout periods, and you're not allowed to deal in anything that is sensitive to market data. So this wouldn't have been allowed anywhere else in the world. In China, they've allowed him to sell those bonds, knowing full well that there was a very high likelihood that the price of those bonds was going to fall significantly in September when everybody became aware of the problems that Evergrande had. And that's exactly what happened, and the price of those bonds fell to less than 15 cents on the dollar once that news was released. And he sold his bonds at prices ranging between 35 and 52 cents on the dollar. So he made tens of millions of dollars profit from the inside information that he had. Now, the other issue here is that this information has only just been released to the market, and we're now in February 2022. So these transactions took place in August 21, and we're looking at a huge delay before this information was released. So the length of time that it's taken for this to become public information is concerning. But what's also concerning is that Evergrande have made no statement whatsoever about these dealings. This is a clear case of insider dealing, no bones about it. This guy knew exactly what he was doing when he sold out of his personal shareholdings and his personal bond holdings just before all the bad news was released. Now, in any other company, you would expect the chief executive to be immediately dismissed and statements to be made about why those deals were done and a public apology to be issued with regards to how this has been managed. But none of that has happened. Evergrande are carrying on as if this is everyday business and nothing untoward has happened. And that's quite surprising because we've got the Risk Management Committee in place right now. So government officials are now running Evergrande. They're telling the chief executive what to do. They're calling the shots and making all the decisions. So it surprises me that they haven't hung this guy out to dry because he is very much in the firing line here. He could easily be sacked over these offences and actually he could face criminal proceedings. So it is really surprising that the Risk Management Committee have not mentioned anything to do with this. They've released the information and that's as far as it's gone so far. Now, maybe there will be a follow-up to this. Maybe we will hear that the chief executive has been dismissed and they will make a statement with regards to this trading. But so far, it's radio silence. Founder and chairman Weikar Yan has come out and made some statements this week regarding Evergrande's current sites and also their targets in terms of number of apartments they're looking to deliver. And he's made a comment with regards to the asset base of the company. So he's made a statement to the market that Evergrande is looking to now recommence all of its construction works across China. So this is 100% of all of their sites, compared with the statement that he made at the end of December that they had 93.2% of all sites operational. And he's gone on to state that the aim for 2022 is to deliver 600,000 apartments. And the final statement that he's made is that Evergrande needs to clear its debt by fully restoring construction and sales activity, not by selling assets on the cheap. And he vowed to complete half of all pre-sold homes this year. So the chairman has come out and made some really interesting statements there. One of his points is that Evergrande has to trade its way out of its current situation. So what he's referring to there is the fact that the amount of debt that Evergrande has is a lot larger than the value of the assets that Evergrande is currently sitting on. So it is impossible to just liquidate the company, cash in all of the assets and pay everybody back because they would have nowhere near enough money to be able to do that. So his belief is that Evergrande should carry on trading, build up some profit, and over time that profit will help pay back all of the lenders. Now, I think he's living in dreamland in terms of they are so far away from being at the level of profitability to pay back these debts, that it's just untrue. But I guess from his point of view, it's his baby. This is something that he created and he wants the business to continue. He doesn't want it to be closed down. Now, one of the problems that he's got is that the level of assets that Evergrande owns is diminishing. Now, I've reported before on this channel that some of the land that Evergrande owns has been seized by local authorities. They've taken that land back because Evergrande was not undertaking any developments. The government is also looking at a lot of the unfinished apartments that Evergrande has and is considering whether they should be moved across to the state-owned entities. We saw the football stadium that Evergrande started construction on being seized by a local authority. So they've lost a lot of assets already. And the more assets they lose, the less viable the business becomes. He claims that over 93% of the sites are currently operational and that they will be recommencing work on all of the other sites by the end of February. Now, one of the problems with that is the fact that they owe a huge amount of money to all of their suppliers. And we reported on this recently. There are a lot of companies who are dependent on Evergrande for their business, who are reporting massive losses, who are laying people off and are complaining about lack of cash flow and are facing bankruptcy themselves. So all of those businesses are in real difficulty. So it's really difficult to see how they will commence work with Evergrande and how Evergrande will get all their sites up and running again, because they've been dealt a hammer blow. They don't have the cash to be able to pay their people, to be able to pay their suppliers, to be able to do the job that Evergrande needs them to do. So we've got a broken infrastructure sitting behind Evergrande. So it's really impossible to see how 100% of these sites can just be switched back on again overnight, because they don't have anybody to be able to come in and do the work, and they don't have any credit left with any of these suppliers. And the final point that he's made is about the number of apartments that Evergrande is intending to complete in 2022. So he's actually stipulated a figure of 600,000 apartments. That's the target that they're shooting for. Now that compares with 1.6 million apartments that have been pre-sold. So they've got 1.6 million customers waiting to move into their apartment. And the 600,000 doesn't even represent 50% of that number. Now, the chairman has actually referenced 50% as part of his statements. So there's a slight inconsistency there, because 50% would obviously represent 800,000, not 600,000. But even if it is 600,000 that he manages to deliver, we've still got 1 million apartments that are unbuilt by the end of 2022. So if we roll forward at the same rate, if we say that they deliver another 600,000 in 2023, then that would still leave 400,000 waiting at the end of 23. So you would be almost at the end of 2024 before Evergrande get to the point where they've delivered these 1.6 million apartments. Now, if you've ever bought a property off plan, then often you might have to wait 2 or 3 or possibly even 6 months for that apartment to be constructed. You're not waiting for 2 or 3 or 4 years. That is an incredible amount of time to wait for an apartment to be built. If you're a young family who needs to move into a house because you've got a baby, you don't want to wait 4 years until your child's actually going to school and maybe you've got another child and a dog and a goldfish. It's just not feasible for people to wait that long. And one of the major problems here is that the structure in China facilitates people paying up front a large amount of money. So we've talked about it a lot on this channel, but we've heard of deposits of up to 100%. So some of these apartments have actually been paid for in full. But even the ones that haven't been paid for in full, we're looking at 10, 20, 30, 50% deposits. So that is a lot of money for most people. That's their life savings. And you can't hand over your life savings and wait 3 or 4 years for that apartment to be built, because you'll be bankrupt by the time it arrives. So this is really unacceptable. And when you look at 600,000 as a target for this year, then that may not even be achieved. Evergrande might come in a lot less than 600,000. And that means there'll be even more people disappointed by the end of this year. So I think the target that's been stipulated doesn't look like it's going to achieve the goal that the government wants. And it's very likely that these building sites and these semi-finished apartments will be taken off Evergrande, because nobody can wait another 2 or 3 years for them to get round to finishing 1.6 million apartments. So I wanted to just pick up on the supplier point again and to remind everybody of some of the things that are going on with Evergrande right now. So one of the first things I wanted to remind you about was the fact that they received a demolition order for their 39 apartment buildings on Ocean Flower Island. Now, there's been no update with regards to that demolition. At the time of the order, Evergrande came out and said that they would comply with the authorities and they were working with them to try and achieve a mutually beneficial outcome. Now, the reason that they got the demolition order was because they are accused of having fraudulent building regulations. They didn't do things by the book, and it's claimed that the build is illegal. So this isn't something to do with a technicality. This is a fundamental issue that the local authority is saying that Evergrande undertook illegal practices and therefore all of those apartments need to be demolished. Now, this is a $1.3 billion build. So this is massive for Evergrande. And none of these apartments are completed. So they may well have pre-sold some of them. So these could be some of the apartments in the 1.6 million that everybody is waiting for. But it's a major problem for Evergrande. They need to either agree some sort of resolution whereby they can carry on with the build and not demolish all of these apartments, or they need to acknowledge that they have done something illegal and that it all needs to be razed to the ground. But either way, they need to advise the market what's going on. There's no point saying we're going to recommence 100% of our sites, apart from the one that's about to be demolished on Ocean Flower Island, which is our prime site. It's our flagship operation. There's been no mention of it since all of the news that came out about the demolition. So that's a major problem that Evergrande has right now, and we don't know at all what's going on with it. One of the other big issues is the relationship with the suppliers. So the chairman has come out and said that he's going to restart everything. But to do that, he needs all his suppliers to restart all of their relations with Evergrande and all of the people who work for those suppliers to come back on site and start doing the building again. And as I reported previously, at the end of December, Evergrande had lawsuits of $13 billion against them from their suppliers. And I've reported since that a lot of the suppliers have come out and issued profits warnings and released accounts that include massive losses, and many of them were taking more legal action against Evergrande. So it's highly likely that the $13 billion of lawsuits at the end of December is now closer to $20 billion of lawsuits. And these are the people that Evergrande are expecting to come back on site and carry on with the builds. But that won't happen in a normal scenario. Unless they are instructed by the authorities in China to come back, they're not going to do that because they're dealing with a client who hasn't paid them and who they're now taking to court. So in normal circumstances, once your relationship gets to that level, it's past the point of no return. You're not going to start working for somebody who you're actually suing currently in the courts. Now, in addition to all of those issues, one other matter that we reported on recently is commercial paper. So commercial paper is used commonly across the whole of China, and it's basically an IOU. Rather than paying your supplier in cash, you issue them with a piece of paper that says, I will pay you in 6 or 12 months' time. And there is a mountain of commercial paper out there that's gone unpaid. Now, in December 2020, Evergrande had $32 billion of commercial paper in issuance. Now, 2021 was a bad year for Evergrande, so it's unlikely to have paid down that commercial paper. It's very likely that they increased the amount of commercial paper that they were issuing. So the $32 billion in December 2020 is likely to be closer to $100 billion now. So Evergrande has a massive amount of debts out there to all of the suppliers that they're expecting to now come and finish all of these half-built apartments. Very unlikely to happen unless the risk management committee gets involved and starts ordering all of these companies to come back on site. So what's the summary in conclusion today? Well, there's two main areas to focus in on here. The first one is the insider trading by the chief executive. In any other country, in any other company in the world, this guy would have been fired upon the news of his trading coming out. He knew full well what was going on at Evergrande. He's the chief executive. He's the main guy. So he would have been fully aware that the company was on the verge of bankruptcy in the summer of 2021. He went ahead and sold $128 million worth of bonds at a preferential price. After he sold them, the price of those bonds fell by around 60 or 70%. So he personally made tens of millions of dollars profit from the knowledge that he had about the poor performance. That is the definition of insider trading. You can't do that. It's illegal. It's actually something that's a criminal offence. If he was in any other country around the world, he would be going on trial and possibly going to prison for this. There's been no mention from the company about this dealing and no repercussions have occurred. So it will be interesting to see whether anything does come out of the woodwork, whether we see something over the next few weeks. But it's incredible that they've made this announcement, told the world what happened, and now they're moving on as if it's an everyday matter. The second issue here is the news that Evergrande is now restarting all of its building sites and carrying on as normal. Now, this is just ludicrous. There's no way that Evergrande will carry on building all of these sites out because they don't have the credit, they don't have the people, and they don't have any cash left. And they've also got a default situation on all of their bonds, and they've asked for 6 months to have a think about what's going on with regards to the restructuring. Now, it's clear to me that what's going on is that this is a PR exercise. The chairman has come out and told everybody it's back to business, everything's fine, we're carrying on as we were. That is a delaying tactic, and it's clear that tied in with the message to the bondholders that they have to wait 6 months, that Evergrande is lining up all of its internal deals. So I think we will see a lot of the assets that have been pre-sold moving to the state-owned entities and being built out by the government. And by the time we get to the end of the 6 months, I think there'll be very little left in the business for the bondholders and the lenders. And at that point, Evergrande will then be shut down. But let's wait and see what happens. It's never a boring week when Evergrande are involved.
This video is an update on the situation in Ukraine. Now, as you may be aware, Russia have been building troops on the Ukraine border, and it looks very likely now that Russia will be invading Ukraine at some point in the very near future. And the stock markets and a lot of other markets around the world are getting very jittery about this approach. And I wanted to post this video to look at what the potential implications of Russia making this invasion are, because it's not just contained to Russia and Ukraine. This could have massive implications for the global economy. So I wanted to go through exactly what it is that Russia are upset about, why the markets are nervous right now, what the position is with regards to China, because China and Russia have a really strong bond, and neither of them are in NATO, and this whole issue is all around the potential of Ukraine joining NATO, and Russia is getting very upset that NATO is expanding the number of countries, and China is also on the same page as Russia with regards to that perspective. So I wanted to go through the Chinese position and then look at what the potential is for China to support Russia and to join forces, and whether or not that could escalate into a potential world war. Now, that sounds a bit sensationalist, but I wanted to go through the potential for that because Russia and China both have internal issues right now, and there is a potential that they could divert a lot of their energy and focus into this Ukraine dispute, and that this could escalate quite quickly. So before we get into all of that, if I could ask you at some point during this video, if you're enjoying the content, to give me a thumbs up, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I include chapters in all of my videos, so if there's a section that you're not that interested in, it's really easy to skip forward onto the next topic. So as you've no doubt seen in the press, Russia have been building their troops on the Ukraine border for a long period of time now, and it looks very likely that they will be invading Ukraine in the near future. So Russia have amassed over 100,000 troops along the Ukraine border, and over the last couple of weeks, they have been undertaking maneuvers and bringing in attack helicopters. And there's a strong rumor that Russia have been filming a fake attack by Ukraine on these Russian troops with a view to using that as a reason for Russia then invading Ukraine. So none of that has been confirmed, but there's a lot of intelligence that's passing through the Western states that is saying that Russia is very close to making this invasion. And we've seen some reaction from a lot of the foreign embassies. We saw the US advising all US citizens to leave Ukraine, and they've evacuated their embassy. The UK have done the same, as have Canada, Germany, Sweden, Kuwait, Australia, New Zealand, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. So everybody's expecting this conflict to start soon. But the big question is, will it have any impact on the global economy? And does anybody care outside of Russia and Ukraine? The stock markets have been reacting very badly to the news of Russia's potential invasion. And there are a number of reasons for that. At times of war, money moves out of stock markets and into safe havens. So that money will look to go to gold and treasury deposits because they're seen as being immune from any major geopolitical issues. So we've seen the stock markets fluctuating quite rapidly over the last few weeks, we've seen some really big dips, particularly in the tech stocks. So anything where there's a lot of future growth built into that business, they are more sensitive to these movements, because if there is some sort of conflict that then escalates and causes other countries to become involved, then that could have a dampening effect on global growth. And when you see reduction in global growth, any speculative stocks that rely upon big hockey stick upturns in revenue are always going to be the first to fall. So that's the general reaction when there's conflict. But there's also some specific reaction, because Russia and Ukraine are exporters. So Russia exports a lot of energy. It's one of the biggest suppliers of oil and natural gas and coal. And Europe is highly dependent on all of those exports. So if we see some form of conflict between Russia and the Ukraine, and the Western world is on the side of Ukraine, then that will mean that there'll be some form of sanctions applied against Russia. So they may ban exports, or they may look to reduce the amount of Russian goods being taken in by other countries. And that will have a big impact, because if you're dependent on imports from Russia, and the sanctions say that you can no longer have those imports, then that's going to hurt your production, because those raw materials won't be coming through, and therefore it could have a knock-on impact to your economy. So the global markets take all of these things into account. It looks into what the potential domino effect could be from sanctions against either Russia or Ukraine. The markets also factor in the potential impact on the global trade, because at times of conflict and war, global trade will reduce. So the markets are very, very nervous about anything that could potentially spill over into having an economic impact. And companies that have specific exposure to Russia and Ukraine and any countries that are supporting any of those nations will also be downgraded rapidly. So we've seen this already, and it's likely to continue. And if the conflict does start, then we will see a big fall in a lot of share prices all across the world. One of the major concerns about a conflict is that Russia is one of the largest exporters of oil, of natural gas and coal. And a lot of countries around the world are dependent on those fuel supplies for powering their power stations and industry. So if a conflict starts and it's decided that sanctions have to be imposed against Russia, then those sanctions will prevent the export of all of that energy to a variety of countries. And we've talked about it before, but natural gas is an area where Russia is absolutely dominant in Europe. It has a number of pipelines that it feeds directly to a variety of countries. So Turkey is dependent on natural gas from Russia, so is Germany, and so is Italy. But a variety of other countries are also dependent on that flow of gas. So if a sanction is applied against the supply of Russian natural gas, then that is going to hurt all of those countries, because they need that fuel to power their power stations and also to feed it to their domestic customers. So that will mean that we will see a reduction in power and potentially have issues with regards to productivity and companies. So there's a really big knock-on impact if Russia do invade Ukraine and any sanctions are applied against its exports, because everybody's dependent upon it. We can't just switch off Russian gas and Russian oil and carry on at the same level of productivity as we are just now. And of course, the flip side of this is that Russia can use their dominant position to leverage their negotiations with regards to what's happening in Ukraine. So they know that Germany and Italy and Turkey are highly dependent upon their fuel. And therefore, if they switch off the pipeline, so even if there are no sanctions imposed by the US, if Russia decides to stop supplying all of that gas, that would have a disastrous impact on all of those countries. So Russia has got a very strong hand here, and it's going to use its position to try to leverage the best possible outcome that it's looking for. Now, the relationship between China and Russia is really important here, because China and Russia have built up a very strong trading relationship over the last 10 years and have now got more than $100 billion worth of trade between the two nations each year. China takes a lot of oil and liquefied natural gas from Russia, so it's using a lot of Russia's energy. And because both of the nations are outside of NATO, they have an affinity. And in a recent meeting between President Putin of Russia and President Xi Jinping of China, they came out and said that they were against NATO growing any further. And China gave a lot of positive messages to Russia that they are behind them in their conflict with Ukraine. Now, they didn't go as far as to say that they supported war, but they did come out and criticise Washington's impact on stability and peace, and also criticise the Australian-US-UK alliance. So there's a very strong relationship between China and Russia right now. And historically, both of them are anti-USA. And there is a potential here that China could use this opportunity to support Russia and start to flex its muscles. Now, we've talked a lot about what's happening in the Chinese economy right now. There are problems. We're seeing a slowdown. We've got major issues with regards to the property developers, but that's also leaking through into the local governments and the high-speed rail network. And if you look at what's happened in history, quite often at times of economic crisis, a country will get involved in some form of military conflict. It's a classic way of uniting the people and getting people to forget about what's going on in terms of the economy and focus in about what's happening from a nationalist perspective. So there is a real possibility here that China could use this conflict as a way of deflecting everybody's attention away from what's happening economically and bring everybody back together. We've got an election coming up in China in the near future. So again, that would be a way of gaining more popularity. If you can be seen against the common aggressor, then that generally brings everybody together. So if that were to happen, if China did join forces with Russia and stood against the rest of the Western world, then it would be really interesting to see what would happen. Because obviously we've got all of the nations in NATO who are supporting the Ukraine, who want to join NATO. And we could see two of the biggest military powers join together against that NATO alliance. Now, one interesting question here with regards to what we've been talking about a lot on this channel is what Turkey's perspective would be. President Erdogan at the moment is trying to be a peace negotiator. So he's not taking sides. He's saying that he doesn't favour NATO and he doesn't favour Russia. He wants there to be an equal outcome. But as we know, Turkey is very dependent on Russian gas. If Russia was to switch off its pipelines on a permanent basis, it would put Turkey into a dire position because they use that gas to produce electricity, which is needed by all of the companies in Turkey to make the exports. So the economy of Turkey is highly dependent on Russian supplies. Now, that doesn't mean that Turkey will automatically join Russia and China in the event that there's a big military conflict. But it would be really interesting to see which way it would land, because Turkey would have to face the real prospect, if they go against Russia, of having their natural gas cut off, which is going to cause real hardship within the country. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, I think the summary here is that this conflict between Ukraine and Russia has much wider implications. It's not just a small conflict in Eastern Europe that doesn't have any impact on the rest of the world. This is something that firstly will have a direct economic impact because Russia is a big exporter. It provides a lot of energy to Europe and the rest of the world, but it also supplies other goods and raw materials. Ukraine supplies some. It supplies corn and vegetable oils to Europe. So there would be a minor impact from the Ukraine's perspective. The Russian impact is much bigger. But the bigger issue here is whether or not this escalates into a bigger conflict. If more countries get drawn in and if more countries start to back Ukraine, then that could put Russia into a very difficult situation. And if they then are supported by China, then we could be looking at a real potential of having a global conflict. We could see this escalate from just a small matter between Russia and its neighbour into something that could be all around the world. It could easily draw in America and China, and then we would be into a potential world war conflict. Now, that's a long way from where we are today, but it is a risk, and that's why the global markets are so jittery, because they know that what can start off as a very minor dispute can actually escalate quite quickly and have a massive impact on the way the world trades for not just a few weeks, but this could roll on for a number of months and even years, because if sanctions are applied against Russia and China, then there may be retaliation from Russia and China from a sanctions and supplies point of view, and that could then hurt other economies in the long term. Now, hopefully none of this will happen. Hopefully we won't see an escalation. Hopefully there'll be some form of agreement that's put together between Russia and Ukraine. But it looks unlikely to be resolved peacefully. Russia have invaded Ukraine before in 2014, and they've been building their troops on the border for quite a long time. So it looks like they're going to push forward with this military action. What happens thereafter will be the key question as to how big an impact this has and whether or not this could trigger a global recession. It could be another black swan event. It could cause a global financial recession. Hopefully it won't. But it's always good when you're looking at the news and thinking about something outside of your own country to think about what the potential global impact of that could be. Because these days, there's very little happening in isolation. We have got a global economy, everybody's interconnected, and therefore what happens in a small part of the world that could be thousands of miles away from where you live could have a massive impact on your life at some point in the near future. This video is an update on the situation in Turkey. I want to run you through a variety of information that's come to light over the last few days. And we'll go through the new scheme that the finance minister is introducing relating to gold. So now he's asking the citizens of Turkey to hand over all of their gold to the state. This follows on from the recent request to hand over all of their foreign currency. I'll update you on some strikes that have been happening in Turkey over the last week or so. We'll talk about some changes to taxes that have been brought in alongside a strong recommendation from the president to all of the food suppliers to reduce their costs. We'll talk about some meetings that the finance minister has held in the UK with investors. I'll tell you about the recommendation he's now giving to all of the banks in Turkey. And then finally, I'll give you an update on what's happening with regards to the journalist who we reported on recently, who was arrested for insulting President Erdogan. But before we get into all of that, if I could ask you to give me a thumbs up at some point during this video, if you're enjoying the content, and please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I always include chapters in my videos. So if there's a section that you're not particularly interested in, it's really easy to skip forward onto the next topic. So it's just been announced that Turkey are now asking all of its citizens to hand over their private holdings of gold to the state in exchange for lira. Turkey wants to build up its gold reserves, and it's now reaching out and trying to get all of its people to hand over its precious supplies of gold. So this is quite a surprising development. Up until now, the finance minister has stated that the foreign currency scheme was going really well and that they were pulling in billions of dollars. However, this can't be the case because they're now having to ask for another scheme to be introduced to further build up the reserves. So it's been reported that the Turkish authorities have done a deal with five gold refineries in Turkey who will melt down all of the jewellery that's handed in by the private citizens, and they will create gold bullion from that jewellery. They've also put in place an agreement with 30,000 different gold merchants across the whole of the country who will be facilitating all of the collection of jewellery from various citizens, and they're also setting up 1,500 drop-off points where people can go along and hand in their jewellery. So a massive operation and really big infrastructure that's been put in place to cover this scheme. And what this shows is that there's a level of desperation within the authorities. The reserves are quite clearly running very low, and they're now having to go to the base metal of gold to try to hold up their economy. And as we've discussed before on the channel, gold is seen as a good store of value. When you've got very high inflation and the value of your money is falling, people want to put their money into a safe haven. You want to put your investments somewhere where it's not going to deteriorate in value. And gold has traditionally been that place where people have gone to. Everybody's comfortable that gold has long-term value. It's a precious metal and there's limited supply of it in the world. So for as long as everyone can remember, gold has been seen as something highly valuable and something that people want. So the fact that the Turkish authorities are now asking all of the citizens to give up their private holdings of gold really shows that there's a major problem right now in Turkey. It's reported that there is over $250 billion worth of gold held privately in Turkey. It's seen as something really desirable by the Turkish citizens, and so everybody likes to have a supply of gold in reserve. And the fact that they're now asking people to hand this over shows that we are into the last chance saloon in terms of what other options the authorities have to get themselves out of this situation. The Turkish minister has stated that he's hopeful that he will get around 10% of the 250 billion of gold that's held by private citizens. So that would equate to $25 billion. So again, not a lot in the context of what we've talked about. If you've been following my postings, you'll know that Turkey spent over $10.5 billion in December supporting the Turkish lira in the international markets and also buying gas to supply the power stations and the citizens of Turkey. So at that rate, even if they did get in $25 billion worth of gold, that would only last for a couple of months at the current rate that they're burning through foreign currency. The current rates of inflation are putting real pressure on the citizens of Turkey, and the cost of everything is rising rapidly. And we're now starting to see some pushback from a variety of sectors. And this week, thousands of healthcare workers undertook a strike in Turkey, protesting at the level of pay. They want their wages to be increased to match the current rates of inflation. And as you'll know, if you follow the channel, we've now got almost 50% inflation in the 12 months to January 2021. So these are the first signs of public unrest about what's going on, but it's likely that we will see more of this sort of action. A lot of the people in Turkey are paid by the state, and therefore the state decides what their pay increases are and how much they should get each month. So we will see more of this if inflation carries on at the rate it's rising, because everybody's losing money in their pocket and the value of lira is continuing to fall. In response to the rising inflation, President Erdogan has just announced that he's reducing the tax on food from 8% to 1% to alleviate the pressure on the Turkish people. So that's a great gesture. But what's interesting about the statement is that he's also gone on to tell all of the food producers in Turkey that he expects them to reduce their prices by 7% alongside this 7% reduction that he's introduced from a tax perspective. Now, this is a really interesting development, because it's one thing for the state to say, well, we'll reduce our taxes to try to give everybody more purchasing power. But what it's impossible to do is to tell private companies that they have to reduce their prices. We're looking at almost 50% inflation in Turkey. So that means that all of these food producers, what they're buying in is rising in cost by around about 50%. So their costs are rising dramatically. And they're being told by the president that they've got to reduce their prices, which basically means that they will be reducing their profit or possibly moving into a loss situation. Food production is notorious for having very low margins. So there isn't a lot of headroom here for these guys to be able to take an axe to their prices and give up all of their profit. So what we will see here, if these food producers are forced to reduce their prices by 7%, is that they will then be making less profit and possibly even making losses. So President Erdogan is putting these Turkish businesses into a very disadvantaged position, and that's unsustainable. You're looking at an economy that needs its businesses to be performing well to support all of the economy and to be able to hire people and pay more wages and the virtuous circle. If you start cutting all of these businesses' throats, then they won't be able to hire more people. They'll have to cut wages, and that's going to have a vicious circle in the opposite direction. So this really isn't something that is feasible for these companies to be able to do. It's one thing cutting taxes, because that's a central decision made by the government for the good of the people. But telling companies to reduce their prices just doesn't work in a capitalist economy. If these were state businesses, then it might be feasible. But these are private entities that he's trying to introduce these policies for. So this really isn't going to work in the long term and is going to cause even more problems in the Turkish economy. The The Turkish finance minister Nureddin Nebati had meetings in London this week with investors trying to raise more capital for the Turkish economy. And his feedback from these meetings was that they were fantastic. And he's very bullish on the situation. And he told all of these investors that the only problem that Turkey has right now is inflation. Everything else is going according to plan. Now, I probably wouldn't agree with his assessment as we're looking at it. There are a lot of issues that are going on right now in Turkey. Inflation is certainly one of them. That's the biggest issue. And that's having a knock-on impact to all of these other factors. But we've also got problems with regards to the strategy that's being implemented to combat inflation. As you'll know if you watch the channel, they've now decided that the right policy to follow is to reduce interest rates, even though common economic policy would tell you that you increase interest rates at a time of high inflation because that calms spending, it reduces people's spending power and therefore brings prices back down. Reducing interest rates usually means that people spend more and forces prices back up. And obviously the other major issue that is going on right now for Turkey is the fact that the Turkish lira fell by 44% in 2021 and is still under immense pressure. And we believe that the Turkish authorities are still supporting the lira in the markets, and that's why the rate has now stabilized against the dollar. But as soon as those reserves run out and they're unable to keep supporting the lira, it's likely that the value will fall again, and that will have a domino effect on all of the other factors in the Turkish economy. So it'll be interesting to see how many of these investors that the finance minister met with in the UK actually come through and make a large investment into the Turkish economy. This week, the Turkish finance minister also confirmed that Turkey will not turn back on its new economic policy. It is going to stick with the philosophy of reducing interest rates at a time of high inflation. And he's now calling on all of the private banks in Turkey to step up and show more effort. Now, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but he's now obviously putting some burden onto the privately owned banks in Turkey to start picking up some of the slack in the economy. Now, this presumably means that he wants more loans put out to the citizens of Turkey, and he wants more money circulated around the economy, and potentially also is an indication that they will want some of the foreign currency reserves that are being held by these private banks to be converted into lira and that currency to be handed over to the state. Again, this is a big issue. It's one thing controlling the state-owned banks and deciding what their policies are going to be and encouraging people to make transfers of foreign currency to lira amongst those deposits. But it's a very different matter when you start telling private businesses what to do. By indicating that the private banks need to show more effort, they're really putting some pressure on all of the operators in Turkey that they need to get involved in these political decisions. And this is really stepping into a different realm. This isn't a financial discussion. This is saying that they want those institutions to start pulling their weight to help Turkey get through this. So we're getting into an area here which is slightly outside of just normal commercial entities and more into helping the economy of Turkey by doing things that are probably not financially driven, but are more politically driven. If you follow the channel, you'll know that a prominent journalist in Turkey, a lady called Sedef Kabas, who's a 52-year-old highly respected financial journalist who appears on TV a lot, was arrested recently for insulting President Erdogan. And the charge of insulting the president was brought in at the time when President Erdogan changed a lot of his powers in 2015, and it carries a maximum jail sentence of 4 years. Now, since she was arrested, she's been held in custody, so she's been in jail continually for the last month or so, and it's now come to light that the charges against her have now been increased. So previously, she had the potential of going to prison for 4 years for the single charge of insulting the president. Now that has been extended, and she's now accused of also insulting the interior minister and the transportation minister. And the combination of those three charges means that she is now facing the potential of 11 years in prison. Now, this all relates to a famous Turkish proverb that she recited on Turkish TV. Now, the president took great exception to this and sent the police to her house at 2 o'clock in the morning where she was with her family, and she was arrested and she's been held in prison ever since. So initially it was hoped that she would be released and the charges would be dropped. However, with these new charges that have now been put forward, It looks more likely that she is definitely going to be held in prison for a long period of time, and it could be anything up to 11 years. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, I think the biggest concern of all the stories today is the fact that Turkey is now asking all of its citizens to hand over their gold. And this isn't gold bullion. They're not talking about wealthy citizens who have tens of billions of dollars of gold bullion tucked away in safe deposit boxes. They are asking people to hand over their personal jewellery, chains and necklaces and earrings, which will be melted down to create new gold bullion for the state. So this shows really that Turkey is getting to the point where it is now really desperate. If it's asking people to hand over its jewellery to be melted down, then we are really at the end of the road in terms of options. There's nothing else left to ask for. They've asked for all of the foreign currency that all the citizens had. They've asked all of the companies in Turkey to hand over 25% of their own foreign currency and also any deposits that they don't need. And now we're at the point where they're asking for jewellery. And the scale of this programme is massive. We've got 30,000 gold shops and 5 major refineries all ready now to start collecting in this gold and melting it down. So I get a lot of comments on the channel about people telling me that there are no problems in Turkey, and references are often made to the level of gold reserves that Turkey has. Now, there's obviously a lot of gold in Turkey, and the private citizens of Turkey are holding over 250 billion of it. But the reason they're doing that is that they've lost confidence in the lira. So everybody has confidence in gold. That is seen as a universal measure for a store of value. The Turkish lira is at the opposite end of the spectrum. It is devaluing on a regular basis. So it'll be interesting to see how much is raised through this scheme, because the citizens of Turkey must be worried now. When you hear a call like this, then the alarm bells will start ringing and you start wondering why the state wants you to hand over your life savings in gold in exchange for Turkish lira, which is reducing in value rapidly. The other issues we've talked about today are also concerning. Strikes are now starting to happen. This is the people of Turkey starting to push back. They can't continue living in a state where inflation is at 50%. It's just impossible. We've got to the point where more than 50% of all the transactions in Turkey are taking place in dollars. Everybody is moving away from the lira, looking for something else where they can hold their net worth. And the strikes are really a reflection of the fact that people are now worried and concerned and unhappy with the way things are being run. The changes to the taxes are trying to appease the people of Turkey, but quite frankly, a 7% reduction in the food prices isn't going to offset a 50% increase in inflation. It will be lost in the roundings. And the finance minister is carrying on as normal. He's talking good game as if everything is all nice and rosy in the garden. But realistically, that isn't the situation. We have got major problems in Turkey right now. And I think they're starting to build up and everything's starting to come to the surface. So within the next 3 to 6 months, I think we will see some big changes in Turkey. It can't continue as it is right now. And we will come to a tipping point at some point very soon. This video is an update on the Evergrande situation. We've just received some news that the authorities are changing the rules with regards to escrow accounts. So in this video, I wanted to talk to you about what an escrow account is, what it's meant to achieve, what the new rules that are being introduced say, and what the implications of that are for both property developers, but also for the buyers in China, because an escrow account is put in place to protect buyers, not to help property developers access more capital. So I wanted to go through the details of what's been announced and then look at what the implications of this are for both Evergrande and also all the rest of the property developers in China, because these new rules have been introduced to try to give the developers access to more capital. But I think fundamentally there is a problem with the way it's been structured. So we'll go through that at the end of the video. But before we get into all of that, I'd really appreciate it if you could give me a thumbs up at some point during this video if you're enjoying the content. And please don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I always include chapters in my videos. So if there's a section that you're not particularly interested in, it's really easy to skip through it and move on to the next topic. Escrow is legal terminology and relates to a situation when money is paid in advance of receiving a certain good or service. And the way that these contracts are structured are that the money that is paid by a buyer is held by a third party in an independent account, and that money is only released to a seller upon the completion of certain conditions. So in the situation of the property developers, the way these accounts are meant to operate, when a buyer comes along and wants to buy an apartment from Evergrande, they agree a price and then they pay an amount up front. So that amount might equate to 50% of the purchase price. So they pay 50% of the purchase price. But in order to protect their position, what is meant to happen is that rather than that money being given to Evergrande, who then theoretically could go away and spend that money, it's put into a deposit account with a third party. And that third party will only release the money to Evergrande upon the completion of either the full apartment, so it's ready for sale, or the contract may stipulate that the money can be released upon the completion of other criteria, such as the completion of the shell or the completion of the second fix of the apartment or something along those lines. And the way this whole scheme is structured is that it's meant to protect the buyers. So if Evergrande, for example, goes bust, then that money is sitting with an independent party and it could be returned to that buyer if they are unable to take completion of their apartment. So escrow accounts are a really good idea when you're parting with large sums of money and the completion of the contract is dependent upon the third party delivering something to your satisfaction. So that's a quick summary of escrow. Hopefully that's given you a better understanding as to what an escrow account is, why these situations have been put in place contractually, and the protection that an escrow gives to a buyer in the event of somebody like Evergrande getting into financial difficulty and not being able to complete on 1.6 million apartments, for example. So it's now been announced by the Chinese authorities that they're changing the rules with regards to escrow accounts because they feel that the rules are too restrictive and that the property developers need to be given access to more cash being held in these accounts. So at the moment, the way the escrow is structured in China, the local authorities hold on to the cash. So theoretically, when a buyer comes along and agrees with Evergrande to buy an apartment, if they hand over $100,000, in theory, Evergrande was meant to give that $100,000 to the local authority, and the local authority then locks it away in a protected account and will only give it to Evergrande once that apartment is completed or Evergrande have met all of the conditions of the contract. So in theory, the local authorities all across China, in all the areas where Evergrande is operating, are sitting with 1.6 million deposits in escrow that they are refusing to release to Evergrande. And the Chinese authorities have now decided that that is unfair on Evergrande and that they should be given more of that cash. So they're changing the rules to make it easier for property developers like Evergrande to be able to access that money. So they'll be able to get more of this cash into their own bank accounts. And it's reported that somewhere between 50 to 70% of all of the pre-sale money is being held currently in escrow by the local authorities. So in theory, by changing these rules, it should allow all of the developers to access more capital, and that should enable them to then complete more projects and to get the whole sector moving again. That's the theory that the Chinese authorities are working upon. So before I move on to talk about the issues that the changes to these rules throw up, I wanted to talk about how all of the property developers have been funding their projects so far. So if we look at Evergrande as the perfect example, Evergrande borrowed money from the banks and international bondholders to buy land. So they borrowed all of that cash and then they bought the land. And then they had to pay for the developments themselves. And they borrowed more money to pay for those developments. So they took on more debt from the Chinese banks and international lenders to complete the build. Now, none of the funding included in the build project came from selling the properties. Pre-selling the properties is completely excluded. So if you go back to what we were talking about the escrow account, the reason that escrow accounts have been established and put in place is to protect the buyers. Because what you don't want is the developer using the buyer's deposit to actually pay for the build. Because at that point, they're already out of cash. If they're having to take money from people to complete the build, then they've run out of money internally. So that means that they're already illiquid and in a state of potential bankruptcy. So the funding structure for these developments never included any of the buyer's deposits. That money equated to profit that the developers were going to achieve at the end of the build. They had their funding from the debt provided by the banks and the institutions. They didn't need to include the buyer's deposits as part of their cash flows. So to be releasing this money to help the developers complete their builds doesn't make any sense. This is just a reflection of the fact that all of these guys have run out of cash. And because of the new three red lines policy that was introduced by the Chinese authorities, they don't have access to enough debt to complete the builds. But it makes no sense to give them this money and does raise a massive question mark about the protection that the escrow account is meant to provide to the buyers. So the changes to these escrow rules raise a variety of issues. And I guess the first issue to discuss here is whether or not these escrow accounts have actually been operating in practice. Because we know that a lot of the property developers are in massive financial difficulty, and Evergrande has over $300 billion of debt, and it doesn't have any cash, it's run out of money. And it seems unlikely that there are now hundreds of millions of dollars of cash in escrow accounts that they can gain access to. The big question is whether or not Evergrande and the major developers actually did hand over all of these deposits at the time they took them from customers, or whether or not they used this capital as part of their cash flows. So that's a big question to be answered, and I guess we won't see the detail on that. But by changing the rules of this scheme, it would explain to buyers in the future why the local authorities no longer have their cash. If they can say that they gave it to Evergrande and the other developers at this point because they wanted to change the rules to speed up the build programs, then that seems like a good rationale as to why they don't have the cash anymore. Whether they have it right now, who knows? But let's assume they do have it. Let's assume all of the local authorities are sitting with hundreds of millions of dollars. Then the question that you have to ask is, why were these escrow accounts put in place in the first place? What was the point of this scheme? And the point was to protect the buyers. So if you hand over your money to a developer and that developer goes bust, the benefit of having an escrow account is that the local authority can say, well, it's okay because we've been holding the money, the developer never saw the cash, and we can give you your money back as the apartment has never been completed. So that was the whole point of why this arrangement was established. So it seems really counterintuitive. At a point when all of the developers are in massive financial difficulty, so they're on the point of defaulting, if not already have defaulted, such as Evergrande and Kaiser, then at this stage, the escrow money should be given back to the buyers, especially as the market is now coming off and prices are falling. If I was a buyer and I was in this situation, I would want my money back. I'd rather say, give me my cash back and I might make another purchase on an apartment in 3 or 6 months' time when the prices have come down and all the developers have sorted out some of their problems. What you don't want is the local authority and the government suddenly changing the rules at the most risky point for you and saying, actually, rather than giving you your money back, we're going to take your money and give it to the developer because they need it, because they're bankrupt and they've run out of cash. So this is their last resort. That is counterintuitive with regards to why this scheme was ever established. It was put in place to protect buyers and it's now being used to bail out the developers. Absolutely crazy. The other main issue here is that the government in China brought in the three red lines policy to try to rein in the property developers. A lot of these companies, especially Evergrande, had been running away with themselves, building up all sorts of developments, borrowing money heavily, and getting themselves in a situation where they were over trading and they didn't have enough cash to be able to finish all of the developments that they had started. So the government decided to change the rules to make it more difficult for these developers to access cash and therefore to bring everybody back in line. So the whole point of the three red lines was to try to shake out the unprofitable developers and to stop all of these crazy practices. So by changing the rules to this escrow account, it's really going against the whole philosophy of why they started making these changes. They wanted to make it more difficult for developers to access capital so that they had to work on profitable operations and use their own cash flow wisely. So it doesn't really follow that they should now give them access to funds that were previously locked away and held by a third party. It doesn't make sense to now give them this money. It's going back on that whole ethos of trying to bring them in line and get them focused on their own cash flow. It's essentially giving them another form of debt. They can now take this cash and use it to complete some of the builds, but what will happen is that they will run out of cash. This essentially will be like another Ponzi scheme, because if you're at the front of the queue right now, then you're okay because your apartment will be completed with some of the money that's getting released from these escrow accounts. But at some point, that money will run out, and there'll be nothing left in the pot, and there will still be hundreds of thousands of apartments unfinished, and there will be nowhere else left to turn. There's no more debt available, and once all the escrow money is gone, that's it. So it will accelerate the build, and it will allow some developments to be completed, and some people will get their apartments. But if you're at the back of the queue, you're doomed. There is no way they're going to be able to complete 1.6 million apartments at Evergrande with this money, because it represents somewhere between 50 and 70% of all of the buyer deposits. So it's not enough to complete all of these apartments. It will complete some of them. So the whole ethos of what they're doing here is counterintuitive to what they've tried to do over the last 18 months or so. They've tried to make it more difficult for the developers. They've tried to bring them back in line. But by releasing this capital, it's basically giving them some more free capital and allowing them to go ahead, carry on building, pretend that nothing's happening, pretend everything's as normal. But once that cash runs out, we'll be in exactly the same situation as we are today. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, as I've just run through, the changes that have been proposed by the Chinese authority to the escrow account system are completely insane, because the whole point of having an escrow system is to provide some buyer protection in the event that the developers get themselves into difficulty. And as we all know, all these developers are in a huge amount of difficulty. This is the worst case scenario from a buyer's point of view. What you don't want is to give your money to somebody who then goes bankrupt and you lose everything and you don't end up with any apartment at the end of it. So the escrow system was actually quite clever, and it did give people some comfort that in the event that Evergrande went bust, they might be able to get some of their money back. The government changing this scheme means that all of these buyers are now fully exposed to the bankruptcy of Evergrande, and they will not be getting a penny back. Some of them might get an apartment if they're very lucky, but the vast majority are now going to lose everything. And we're talking lots of money here. It's tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars. In some cases, it's people's life savings. So the government changing this scheme is essentially moving away from protecting the people and moving more towards helping the developers to get through this next period. And that has to be politically driven. We know the property market is on its knees. We've got falling prices. We've got falling volumes in China. It's a really bad situation, and it represents over 25% of GDP in China. So the government clearly wants the sector to be fueled up again. It wants things to get back up and running. It wants to pretend that it can get back to where it was. And by releasing this capital, it will keep things moving for a few months. But this capital will run out, and we will get back to the same situation very quickly. So it's a short-term measure, very short-sighted, doesn't make any sense, and I think is a really bad development from a buyer perspective. And it's surprising, because up until now, the common prosperity for all policy has been looking to support the people of China ahead of all of these corporates. But this change seems to be moving back towards supporting the corporates and moving away from supporting the citizens of China. So time will tell whether or not this makes a difference, and it will be interesting to see how much money has actually been given over by Evergrande and the other developers to the local authorities. My guess is that it is a lot less than 50 to 70% of the total amount that Evergrande took from the 1.6 million buyers who are still waiting for their apartments to be completed. But let's see. This video is another update on the situation in Turkey. And today we're looking at Fitch, the rating agency, who have just updated their rating for the Turkish risk. And it's been downgraded, as you might expect, given everything that's going on in Turkey. So in this video, I wanted to run you through the rating that Fitch have now given to Turkey, who Fitch are and what rating agencies do, and why they're important in the general scheme of things. This isn't just a commentator. It's not like a press article on Turkey that's making comments on what they think about the risk of Turkey going forward. This is actually really important in terms of sovereign debt and bonds issued by the country and just the general appetite for everybody to take on debt from Turkey. So it is really important. And what I wanted to do is give you a better understanding as to what the rating agency has said, who they are, and what the perspective is. So before we get into all of that, if you could give me a thumbs up at some point during this video, if you're enjoying the content, I'd really appreciate it. And please subscribe if you haven't done so already. And don't forget that I include chapters in these videos. So if there's a section that you're not particularly interested in, it's really easy to skip forward onto the next one. The rating agencies are independent bodies who have analysts who review companies and also countries and issue ratings based on their assessment as to what they believe is the risk profile of that company or country. And internationally, there are three major rating agencies that everybody looks to for these official ratings, and they are Moody's, Standard and Poor's, often referred to as S&P, and Fitch. Standard and Poor's is officially the oldest of the three rating agencies and was established in 1906 as the Standard Statistics Bureau. It later acquired Poor's Publishing in 1941, and the new name of Standard and Poor's was put in place at that time. Moody's was established by John Moody in 1909, and Fitch was established in 1914 by John Fitch. Today, all three rating agencies are seen as having similar credibility, and the only key difference between the three is the companies and countries that they cover, because they don't all cover everything. And the key function and the main reason why rating agencies are really important today relate to debt. So all bonds that are issued look to have an official rating. It helps them to sell the bond. And a lot of funds will only take on bonds that have an official rating from one of these agencies. And many of the funds will only take on investment grade bonds. So that is the highest level of rating that you can achieve. And there's different levels within investment grade. So generally, there are four different categories of investment grade. And as long as a bond is rated in those four categories, then any fund can take on that bond. As and when a bond starts to deteriorate in terms of its risk profile, then the rating agencies will change their rating. And if a bond moves from investment grade to non-investment grade, then that often means that a fund can no longer hold that bond. And that's when we see bonds starting to be sold in the secondary market, as a pension fund or another fund may decide that they want to dispose of that credit risk and replace it with another investment grade bond. So the rating agencies hold a really important part in the whole of the financial structure. They're doing a lot of work for the fund managers. They are constantly looking at what's going on within a company. So they'll look at what's happening with regards to their sales and their forecasts and what's happening in the market and what's happening with regards to competition. And so they're constantly adjusting their ratings based on company specific factors, but they're also looking at the wider environment. So they may be looking at what's happening with regards to that sector that that company operates within. And if the sector is starting to deteriorate or it's becoming more difficult to operate in that sector, or the raw materials are rising in price, or other factors are affecting that sector, then they may downgrade the company based upon the sector. And they'll also look at country and geopolitical factors. So if a company is based in a particular country or has a lot of manufacturing in a country where there are political risks, for example, then they may downgrade that company. So as an example, if you had a mining company and it had mines in a country where there was a civil war, then that company could get downgraded because the supply of materials from that mine may be affected by what's happening with regards to the military conflict. So there's a number of different factors that the rating agencies include in their analysis of every company. And they regularly publish updated reports and ratings for all companies. And when there is a change in the rating, this impacts not only on the existing bonds that a company has in the market, but also the ability to raise new bonds. And that's a really important factor. So if a company is downgraded from investment grade to non-investment grade, then that will mean that if they want to issue new bonds, then firstly, the price will go up because issuing as a non-investment grade issuer is more expensive because the risk is higher, and therefore you have to compensate anybody who wants to take on your bond with higher coupon. But it will also make it more difficult because there are less buyers of non-investment grade bonds. For exactly the same reason we just talked about, a lot of the funds are unable to buy non-investment grade bonds. It's not part of their strategy. So a higher risk bond will have a much smaller market and therefore will be more difficult to place. And this is one of the issues that we've talked about a lot on this channel with regards to the Chinese property developers. A lot of these developers started off as investment grade. They were seen as being really good credit risks and not an area where you were ever going to lose any money. And as the market has started to unwind and as the problems have started to come out, we've seen most of the Chinese property developers move from investment grade to non-investment grade. And that's now causing a massive problem in the market because they've got hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds that are maturing and they're unable to refinance them. So they can't issue new bonds to pay off the old bonds because the credit risk is now too high and nobody wants to buy them. So the rating agencies are really important because they are basically telling the market how risky a company or a country is. And if they downgrade a company or a country, then it becomes less attractive to the market and it makes it a lot more difficult for that company or country to raise new debt in the future. Fitch has 11 different ratings that it applies to borrowers. So let's run through all of those ratings and have a quick look at the definition of each. So the highest rating that Fitch gives is AAA. This is the highest credit quality that you can achieve. And it's defined as being the lowest expectation of default risk. They are assigned only in cases of exceptionally strong capacity for payment of financial commitments. The capacity is highly unlikely to be adversely affected by foreseeable events. So that is the holy grail for all companies. If you can achieve AAA status, then that is going to be the lowest possible cost in the market and the easiest way to be able to raise that money. Next is AA, which is very high credit quality and denotes expectations of very low default risk. They indicate very strong capacity for payment of financial commitments, and the capacity is not significantly vulnerable to foreseeable events. So not quite as good as AAA, but still highly desirable and will result in a low cost of borrowing for the company or country. The third level of investment grade rating is single A. And single A is defined as a capacity for payment of financial commitments to be considered strong. This capacity may nevertheless be more vulnerable to adverse business or economic conditions than in the case for higher ratings. So we're starting to see some elements of risk coming in to the single A rating. And the final rating that sits within the investment grade bracket is triple B. And triple B is defined as expectations of default risk currently low. Capacity for payment of financial commitments is considered adequate, but adverse business or economic conditions are more likely to impair this capacity. So we're starting to get to the point where there is a risk of this business being affected by wider economic and business related factors, so it could become non-investment grade. The highest level of non-investment grade category is double B. And double B is classified as indicating an elevated vulnerability to default risk, particularly in the event of adverse changes in business or economic conditions over time. However, business or financial flexibility exists that supports the servicing of financial commitments. So this rating is not a death sentence. It's still okay, but there are some more risks associated than any of the investment grade ratings. Next on the list is single B, which is described as highly speculative and indicates that material default risk is present, but a limited margin of safety remains. Financial commitments are currently being met. However, capacity for continued payment is vulnerable to deterioration in the business and economic environment. Next on the list is triple C, or the hooks, the three hooks as this is referred to. And this is substantial credit risk. And the definition is very low margin for safety. Default is a real possibility. So triple C is sitting just above the default ratings. And once you're getting to this level, there is a high risk that the company is going to get into financial difficulty. Double C is defined as very high level of credit risk. Default of some kind appears probable. Single C is near default. A default or default-like process has begun, or the issuer is in standstill, or for a closed funding vehicle, payment capacity is irrevocably impaired. RD is restricted default and defined as a company that has experienced an uncured payment default or distressed debt exchange on a bond loan or other material financial obligation, but has not entered into bankruptcy filings, administration, receivership, liquidation, or other formal winding up procedure, and has not otherwise ceased operating. And finally, we've got D, which is default, and indicates an issuer that, in Finch's opinion, has entered into bankruptcy filings, administration, receivership, liquidation, or other formal winding up procedure, or that has otherwise ceased business. So let's have a look at the report that Fitch have just released on Turkey. So as you can see, Fitch have reduced the rating from double B minus to single B plus, and their outlook is negative for Turkey. If we look at some of the specifics in their report here, the downgrade of Turkey's issuer default rating and the negative outlook reflects the following key rating drivers and their relative weights. Policy-driven financial stress episodes of higher frequency and intensity have increased Turkey's vulnerabilities in terms of high inflation, low external liquidity, and weak policy credibility. Fitch does not expect the authority's policy response to reduce inflation, including FX-protected deposits, targeted credit, and capital flow measures will sustainably ease macroeconomic and financial stability risks. So this is basically referring to Turkey's counterintuitive policies of reducing interest rates at the time of high inflation. General economic theory tells you that at high inflation periods, you should increase interest rates to reduce people's appetite for spending and therefore bring prices back down. Turkey are following the opposite approach, and obviously Fitch do not buy into this concept. Fitch have gone on to say that Turkey's expansionary policy mix, including deeply negative real rates, could entrench inflation at high levels, increase the exposure of public finances to exchange rate depreciation and inflation, and eventually weigh on domestic confidence and reignite pressures on internal reserves. The risk of additional destabilizing monetary policy easing or stimulus policies ahead of the 2023 general elections is high, and there's an elevated degree of uncertainty about the authority's policy reaction function in the event of another episode of financial stress, as political considerations limit the central bank's ability to raise its policy rate. So what Fitch is saying here is that it's concerned that political issues are more important than the economic focus of bringing down inflation. They believe that the upcoming election and the general focus for President Erdogan to make sure that he remains in power could mean that the policies that are being used right now are detrimental to the growth of Turkey. So they are concerned that politics are overtaking the economics in this situation, and that's one of the reasons that they have a negative outlook for Turkey over the next 12 months or so. Fitch have gone on to make statements about the new policies that have been brought in to bring in foreign currency. They've said that the Turkish authorities expect that the introduction of FX protected deposits, combined with a broader strategy to encourage liraization of the financial system, will support exchange rate stability and in turn facilitate a reduction in inflationary pressures. The new mechanism expanded from retail depositors to corporates, non-residents and Turkish citizens abroad will compensate term deposit holders if the lira depreciation is greater than the nominal interest rate. As of 9th of February, FX protected deposits were 313 billion Turkish lira, 5.8% of total deposits, and corporates are expected to increase participation due to tax benefits. In Fitch's view, the new instrument's capacity to sustainably improve confidence is limited in an environment of high and rising inflation, as well as unanchored expectations. Moreover, if the instrument fails to reduce domestic demand for FX, preserving a stable exchange rate without the use of interest rates would require renewed FX intervention or additional capital flow measures similar to those recently introduced, requiring the sale of 25% of exporters' revenues, as well as tighter controls to monitor that credit allocations do not add to FX demand. This policy response could in turn have a negative effect on domestic confidence. So Fitch are basically saying here that they do not believe that the protected deposit schemes are going to work. They're not going to raise enough capital. And also the confidence factor in the lira is the key issue here. And they are questioning whether or not this has solved that confidence factor. And Fitch are indicating that they believe that further support will be required in the currency markets to maintain the value of the lira. And that, of course, is very expensive to the Turkish authorities and is a big problem for them because they don't have very much in terms of foreign currency reserves left. The final issue that we'll touch on here from this report is inflation. Now, Fitch have stated that inflation rose to 48% in January and price pressures remain high, with producer price index close to 94%, partly reflecting international commodity prices and supply chain disruptions. Continued exchange rate pass-through, rising inflation expectations and utility price and wages hikes. We forecast inflation to reach 38% by the end of the year and average 41% in 2022 and 28% in 2023. The second highest among all Fitch-rated sovereigns. Backward indexation, failure of the authorities to rein in expectations, and additional exchange rate volatility represent risks to our inflation forecasts. So Fitch are basically saying here that they expect inflation to remain extremely high in Turkey over the next 2 years. Rates of 41% and 28% are still unbelievably high and not sustainable. It's not possible to operate normal policies in light of those levels of inflation. And the problem that we've got is that the Turkish authorities are also operating this contrarian view where they are trying to reduce interest rates at the time of extremely high inflation. So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, Fitch have really confirmed a lot of what we've been talking about on this channel. We all know what the issues are in Turkey right now. They've got runaway inflation. It's touching 50% right now, and it's not expected to come down anytime soon. Fitch are forecasting an average rate of inflation for the whole of 2022 of 41%. And when you've got that level of inflation, it's really difficult to be able to manage the country effectively. And Fitch have downgraded the rating from double B to single B. So it was already non-investment grade and classified as junk, but it's now even higher junk status. We're one above triple C, which is basically into default territory. So Fitch have primed everybody that Turkey is now sitting just above default status, and with a negative outlook for the next year, it's likely that they will be moved into a default situation. And that's really important because we've got a huge amount of Turkish sovereign debt that needs to be refinanced in 2022. Fitch have estimated that Turkey has $167 billion worth of bonds that need to be renewed during the year. And as they downgrade the rating, it's going to be more expensive for Turkey to refinance those bonds. But more importantly, it might be impossible because they're moving deeper into non-investment grade territory. They're almost at default level. And if they hit default, it will be impossible for Turkey to be able to renew those bonds. In a normal set of circumstances, what would happen is when those bonds come up for renewal, Turkey would issue new bonds and use the money raised from the new bonds to pay off the old bonds. If you're classified as being in default in terms of your rating, then it won't be possible to raise those new bonds, and therefore you'll have maturing bonds that you can't afford to repay, and you will be in an actual default. And this is what we've been talking about on the channel for some time, that Turkey looks like it's heading into a default, and it will probably need to have some form of bailout, either from the IMF or the World Bank or some other international agency. Now, President Erdogan won't want to do that. He doesn't want to be classified as being in default, and he won't want to have any form of bailout. But the rating agencies are all expecting that to happen. They're downgrading the status of Turkey, and that means that their bonds are becoming more expensive and less attractive. So it is starting to hit them in terms of their international position. This is something that is going to be a major problem for Turkey in the very short term. In the next 3 to 6 months, we're likely to see Turkey downgraded to default status, and therefore all of these bonds are at risk of not being able to be refinanced. So hopefully you found this video interesting. I wanted to go into a bit more depth about what the rating agencies are, how they go about looking at businesses and countries, and why they're important in the general scheme of things, why you should care about Fitch and their ratings. Hopefully you've got a better understanding now than you did at the start of the video. If you've liked what I've said today, then please give me a thumbs up, and don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done so already.